This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Success leaves clues. And if you can grow your economy and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and become more sustainable, not just in terms of Mother Nature, but from a market perspective, then I think we're going to build more fans and supporters and get more people to become converts. And I think there's hope, despite the pessimism of the moment. And I really do. I'm not just saying that naively. I'm saying that based on his history. And history is not kind to idlers. So let us not be idle. But to those that are resilient and can adapt, history is very favorable. And the environmental issue is all about adaptability. It's all about resilience. And if we're flexible and resilient, we'll thrive.
How does Gavin Newsom maintain his optimism in the face of all the destructive policies the president-elect might enact? That's part of what we talk about today on Sea Change Radio in the second half of our discussion with California's lieutenant governor. We also hear Newsom's ideas on the future of public transportation, including self-driving vehicles, his thoughts on the ongoing drought, and why he's not particularly hopeful for the Delta Tunnels project. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the Lieutenant Governor of California and the former Mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom. Gavin, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
California's in the midst of a historic drought. That water is the gold of the state, and it's the currency of the future. The Delta Tunnels project is one that has been bandied about, and it's very controversial. It seems like its support for the project may have dwindled. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, the Brown administration is very supportive, and Governor Brown is making this really part of his legacy. But if I were to be objective, and I know it's not an easy thing as this lieutenant governor to be objective, but in my subjective role, let me objectively attempt to analyze its status. I agree with you that it's been substantially diminished for a number of reasons. Costs, number two, the challenges that we will have with a Trump administration. So the new federal administration. Number three.
Could you expand on that a little bit quickly?
You had an administration, the Obama administration, that was more likely to work with the current administration to find remedies, executive remedies, to find regulatory opportunities to actually collaborate a little bit more with the Democratic administration.
I see.
So you can look at all kinds of, you know, in ways large and small.
Could you maybe explain for our listeners around the country what the Delta Tunnels project is?
Yeah, so the Delta is the area that a number of years ago was identified as one of the three most vulnerable areas in the United States of America.
The Sacramento Delta.
Sacramento Delta. This is the area sort of feeding from Sacramento, the state capital, into the San Francisco Bay. It's one of the world's great estuaries. It's one of the most dynamic environmental areas, but it's also the source of so much of the water for not just the region, but for the state more broadly. And it's been part of a long history of debate about access and availability of water. There was a proposal back when Jerry Brown was first governor in the 70s for a peripheral canal that in essence would take more of Northern California's water and ship it down to the south and Central Valley and the southern part of the state. So it's really divided the state north-south. It's more complicated than that, but that's how it's been more broadly defined. The goal for the current administration now, Governor Brown in his fourth term, is to develop two large tunnels and invest roughly $15 billion, plus or minus, to take tunnels and to get water and in a more reliable way, pump those waters. And by the way, these are tunnels that are about the size of the Channel between France and England.
That 30, gives you a sense. 40 feet high,
They're
right?
Massive tunnels, massive public works project. This is not small pipes.
And the costs are
$15 billion. It was originally $25
billion. And some say it could be $80
billion. Exactly. Anytime you hear anyone estimate the costs, probably double it to begin with. That's sort of, you know, tongue in cheek, but fair point. $15 billion is the sticker price advertised. And the idea is to create more reliability, to address endangered species, the Delta smelt, Chinook salmon, to address salinity issues as it relates to the Delta, to upgrade some of the Delta levees around earthquake concerns and considerations, and to provide more resource, or at least more predictability of water resource in the central part of the state, not just the southern part of the state, though both are beneficiaries. That's all been challenged, not just by the issues that I think will present themselves with the Trump administration, but also around issues of cost. And third, the concern now that the payers, the rate payers, this is a revenue bond, rate payers would pay for the cost of construction. It's not a general obligation.
And that's where those costs could get higher.
And the costs could get higher. So people are saying, all right, if I'm going to pay for it, which are not the folks necessarily in the Bay Area, Northern California, it's folks in the Central Valley and southern part of the state. They're saying, well, if we're going to pay for it, thank you. We believe there may be more reliability, but we actually now want more water. We don't just want more reliability because if we're going to pay this price, we want more of it. And the more of it is, you know, fighting words. And that's where the coalition is beginning to fray a little bit. The Valley, I go in the Central Valley, and frankly, folks are mixed down there. It's not unanimous, they're for it. And they're not necessarily against it, but they want a little bit more assurance that we're gonna get more water. And the folks in the southern part of the state are saying, you know what, this 4 years of drought, entering a fifth year, has forced us to think anew about water policy and to become more autonomous, more independent, focus on water recycling, focus on toilet tap strategies, focus on groundwater replenishment, focus on efficiency, focus on stormwater capture, focus on basically becoming more autonomous, even with desal in Carlsbad. The largest desal facility, Western Hemisphere, just opened in San Diego County.
Which we always
area.
Hear that's so expensive, desalination, but this Delta Tunnels project may be
challenged with it. All of this has sort of muddied the proverbial waters on this. That said, the governor was successful in defeating an initiative that would have killed the tunnels and is now has a green light to politically, quote unquote, figure this thing out. And I think the question will be called in the next year. If he does not succeed with the tunnels, the problem doesn't go away. The Delta remains an outstanding concern and issue. You can't just keep the conditions the way they are.
How connected to the drought is
challenge.
That?
I think it's significant because it puts more pressure on that precious water flow. And the big concern now with the Trump administration is the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act being in peril.
And they say there's no drought. Like when he was out here campaigning, there's no drought. It's just we need to like get not familiar with what a lake is.
Carly Fiorini, they have no clue what they're talking about. I mean, it really was profoundly naive to say there was no drought and patently insulting. Maybe one of the reasons he lost 2-1 in California. And even the farmers out there that are going to rely on his good graces probably rolling their eyes. The fact is, though, there is a lot of water in the northern part of the state, but 2/3 of the population lives in the southern part of the state. So the water flows don't necessarily work where the population is concentrated. And that's been an historic problem, and it's exacerbated in a drought. And now this trade-off between urban and rural, the water consumption that's off the charts for ag, it's relatively modest for urban users, is exacerbated because in a drought we called for rationing. And our urban users are saying, well, why are we rationing when we don't use that much water comparatively compared to ag? And ag saying, hold on, our water flows have been down substantially.
Changing the types of crops we grow.
And and so all the and if you want to get in the business of prescribing what kind of crops, well, is that a democracy? Or is that you know a market that's no longer free when government is determining what you can do with your land as opposed to the market forces it? So it gets into a lot of interesting and complicated issues. And as you say, these they're actually producing something with the water. This water is not, quote unquote, just, I know some people want to dismissively say it's being wasted, but it's being wasted to actually produce the feed for the cattle that are producing the milk for your kids. It's being wasted to produce that bowl of lettuce that you're having tonight, or the avocado that you're enjoying in your turkey sandwich. So, you know, we have to be careful not to be too dismissive of the agricultural interests, which also have an economic impact beyond just the job component and the social justice components related to a lot of the rural economy that does require a vibrant agricultural base. So all these issues are complicated. The tunnels are profoundly complicated. I think it's a 50-50 proposition personally, and the governor is going to do everything he can to pull this thing off, but I think it's going to be a big, big challenge for him.
Is it fair to say that they're throwing out their dream scenario for something, that this is a big engineering vision and it can be scaled back or transmogrified into something
privately
that will be a little more practical?
Yeah, privately the governor's office has been messaging that, and it's not so private, so I can share it. But originally it was a $25 billion project. It's now down to $15 billion, which suggests they've already made some modifications. And most of that was on environmental, not necessarily on the large-scale construction and the tunnels themselves. But I can assure you there are subsequent compromises that are anticipated and proposals that will be made public very shortly that will ultimately reinforce your observation and your question. This is not the proposal. That's the final proposal, put it that way.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. One of the philosophical differences I saw throughout this campaign that I think had a lot of us shaking our heads was being able to promise the moon, but not ask for any sacrifice. You read any article about California's clean energy proposals and will it lead to higher electricity costs? Will it lead to higher gas prices? You know, or let's flip that over to water usage. You drive down Highway 5, you're going to see, thanks, Nancy Pelosi. You know, somebody's blaming somebody for not getting that water, however rational or irrational it may be.
Yeah, right.
High-speed rail.
Right.
There's a lot of not in my backyard NIMBYism. Like, there's not a lot of sacrifice. How does a politician like yourself call it like it is and ask an electorate that's been fed for the last 40 years endless tax cuts with endless growth as this kind of magical thinking? How do we get past that? Because we need more than magical thinking to really make these changes.
No, I think, this is going to be the challenge of the Trump administration, right? Is to follow through on everything they promoted and somehow suggest they go back to a world that no longer exists, and they're going to have abundant coal operations, and they're going to bring back manufacturing and actual jobs associated with that manufacturing. And most objective observers sort of laugh at the prospect of that because they recognize the tech genie's out of the bottle, coal itself has been under threat because of natural gas. Coal's fate and future is very limited here in the United States, and the manufacturing world is being substantially automated and maybe coming back and onshoring, but the reality is not coming back with the same same number of jobs by any stretch of the imagination. So yeah, you have to be honest with folks, but you don't have to be sort of dystopian about it. I think you can have an optimistic and honest conversation about not necessarily sacrifices, but trade-offs and the transition and paint a bright future. People want at least a sense of optimism about their future. And even if it requires the white water of change to go from something old to something new, at least we have to paint the vibrancy of the future. And when it comes to the environment, I don't see it as a massive sacrifice. I really don't. It's kind of, for me, like the Olympics. If you, even if you don't make it on the team, you're going to be a lot healthier. Meaning, even if you don't actually achieve your goals, the economy is going to be healthier because we're going to be, by definition, more efficient. We'll have a more sustainable mindset, less situational. It will force innovation. It will force behavioral change that ultimately, I think, will inure more favorably long term. So even if there's some short term friction in terms of that change, I don't see it as the kind of trade-off that some suggest. I think we've proven, again, the tyranny of or is can be replaced with the genius of and, that you can do certain things and, as you change behavior and animate behavior, and actually produce more positive outcomes. My point is this. Per unit, the cost of energy may be higher in California, but because of our energy efficiency, your bill actually can be a little bit lower. That we can transition from dirty fuels, and as we transition, create real jobs and opportunity with large-scale solar plants and solar thermal and geothermal strategies and rooftop solar, and actually paint a brighter picture. And so I've seen the argument for sacrifice, but I think when it comes to environmental sustainability, environmental stewardship, I'm not convinced that we have to be so pessimistic about those trade-offs.
I think public transportation is really an opportunity to make people see things in a different way than they do now. I forget the percentage, but a very low percentage, surprisingly low percentage of Americans have a passport. They don't.
Yeah,
but when I lived in Japan for 4 years, and you look in the ads for apartments, every little thing has how many minute walk to a train station. That boosts the value of your place significantly.
Yeah,
if you're 2 minutes away from a major train station, you can get from A to B in this labyrinth of a city very quickly. And what's encouraging is that the younger generation, they prefer to have a cell phone over a driver's license. They don't necessarily want
anymore. In 15 years, some people will have driver's licenses and they'll pay a huge penalty. I mean, the DMV, as we know it, is dead. I was just in the Uber driverless cars last week going in rush hour here in San Francisco. It's here. The technology exists. In 10, 15 years, it's going to exist at scale. The whole experience of transportation is radically realigning itself. I mean, Ford just announced they're a mobility company. They're recognizing the nature of car sales are going to radically change the likelihood of all of us owning a car or having two or three cars in the family.
Wait, take a step back. You were in the Uber driverless
car? I was literally being driven around by a driverless car last week in rush hour traffic with two engineers in the back seat with the car driving. I was 6 months ago, literally with my son at Sears Point Raceway in Northern California in Sonoma, driving 108 miles an hour on the Sears Point racetrack with no one in the driver's seat, in the back seat with a person in the front passenger seat with a kill switch just in case. I don't believe that future is that far away, and it's going to radically change the relationship we have with our cars. It's going to change our land use policies, our parking ratios as it relates to housing, change the affordability issues related to housing by reducing the cost of housing associated with having garages. It's going to significantly change mobility writ large, and it's going to have trucking literally about three blocks from where we are doing this interview. Uber has their trucking headquarters where they do their manufacturing here in San Francisco in a warehouse. And they have, I saw four of those large trucks that they've been testing now in Nevada. Their cars are being tested in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, the city. And now they're going to start being tested in other cities across the country. Again, the whole relation, everything about transportation is radically going to change. And again, our kids, my kids, certainly are not going to go to the drivers, go to a DMV that we know today. It will be irrelevant because they're, you know, if you're going to drive, you're going to have higher insurance. If you're going to drive, you're going to pay a penalty for driving because you're more dangerous. You're more likely to create problems in an automated world. And I should note, this is not, again, this is not science fiction. The likelihood we're going to have drones delivering, not packages, but people, in the next 10, 15 years is significant as well. They're already testing drone technology with pods for individuals' transportation. So we're already seeing suborbital flights. You're already seeing nature of cars. Whole issue of transportation, I think, is going to be radically disrupted in the next 10, 15 years. And I think that's ultimately going to be a net positive for the environment.
What did your wife say when you took your child?
My son, Hunter. There's a picture of him and me in the car in USA Today. It was a thrill for my son. It was one of the highlights he talks about with everybody. Going 108 miles an hour, quite literally, around this track. And again, that was 6 months ago. And that technology is already exists in the 2017 models that are coming out at Audi. And the driverless technology that Uber's testing, they're one of many folks that are testing, again, is 4 or 5 years out from being readily available in cities large and small. 10 years from now, you'll whistle up like you did a horse in an old black and white Western. You'll have your app, and your car will pick you up, and then your car will find its own parking space. And the reality is you don't necessarily need a car, which means cars are going to radically be redesigned because they'll become, there'll be cars that will be sold like suites in a hotel room, you know, your executive suites, your pods for this or that. I mean, again, this is a future that we will experience. It's a future I've already had the privilege of experiencing in beta, but ultimately will be scaled. Again, you can't have the same conversations we've been having the last 50 years. Technology is about to enter its exponential phase. I mean, it was 10 years ago where Twitter was still a sound, Facebook didn't exist, the cloud was still in the sky, 4G was a parking space, LinkedIn was a prison, big data was a rap star, Skype for most of us was a typo. Those were 10 years ago. And now you're entering this exponential phase where additive manufacturing and smart metals, genomics and synthetic biology, what's happening with artificial intelligence and big data, and the combinatorial nature of technology, I think is going to be truly disruptive. And as a consequence, again, the future of work is going to be, I think, a more challenging topic for conversation for elected officials like myself. But from an environmental framework, I think it's going to radically change the paradigm as it relates to one of our great polluting problems, and that's transportation writ large.
20 years ago when I got a car in Tokyo, I had to go down to City Hall, and you have to prove that you have a parking space. You can't get a car without proving you have a parking, and that's pretty standard in Asia.
Yeah, it won't be the case in the future. Because the parking spaces, there'll just be a different relationship with on-street parking and access. Sidewalks will be redesigned, pedestrian. The land use is going to radically change our thinking. I mean, the idea that we're having, we're doing developments that are supposed to be around for 50 years and we're designing these large parking areas, it completely dismisses the world that we're about to enter into. It's rather preposterous. Planning and zoning is going to radically change in real time. And I don't think people fully appreciate how quickly that reality is going to take shape.
And now it's winter. Winter in America. All of the healers done been killed. Sent away. Yeah, the people know it's winter. Winter in America.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom.
Listening to you talk about these important policy issues makes me hopeful. We have been through a lot the last couple of weeks as a nation and shaking our heads. And you said we all have to think locally. And personally, I wanted to think so locally that I just didn't want to. It's hard. We haven't discussed the name TRUMP on Sea Change Radio since the election. And I'm in no hurry to talk about it. But we got a puppy at the Wise household. That's what we did. And we focused in our circle and family and friends. But hearing you, somebody who's in a important elected position to make significant change, that you care about this policy in a deep, profound way, should make all of us hopeful. And I want to thank you for that.
I appreciate that. And look, one thing I know is we're resilient, and this nation's resilient, this state's resilient. And I have absolute optimism about our fate and future. I really do. My framework's not scarcity, it's abundance. I really believe that. I think we have limitless capacity, and I don't think the American dream is dead because of the ascendancy of this new president-elect. And I see already, interestingly, him thawing a bit on the Paris Accords, which he had campaigned to kill. Yeah. Now he's saying, I'm open.
It's just whoever gets to him last gets to him. But he's got Myron Ebell and Thomas Pyle in there.
But you know what? So did the Bush administration. We survived it. We didn't thrive during it. We survived it. So did we with Watt and the Reagan administration. We survived it. We didn't thrive during it. My only point is you got to deal with reality. You can't deny it. And we can then retreat from it, or we can step up, step in, and be bold. And this is California at scale. It's going to lead the world in low-carbon green growth strategies. We're going to radically change the way we produce and consume energy. And I believe in federalism. I believe in states' rights. I believe you can punch above your weight. I believe that when I was mayor of San Francisco, that was the greenest, most sustainable city in the greenest and most sustainable state. And I believe ultimately we're going to have an impact beyond our borders here in California, across the rest of the nation and the world. Success leaves clues. And if you can grow your economy and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions and become more sustainable, not just in terms of Mother Nature, but from a market perspective, then I think we're going to build more fans and supporters and get more people to become converts. And I think there's hope, despite the pessimism of the moment. And I really do. I'm not just saying that naively. I'm saying that based on his history. And history is not kind to idlers, so let us not be idle. But to those that are resilient and can adapt, history is very favorable. And the environmental issue is all about adaptability. It's all about resilience. And if we're flexible and resilient, we'll thrive.
He's the Lieutenant Governor of California, Gavin Newsom. Gavin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Grateful. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by AIM, The Rolling Stones, and Gil Scott-Heron.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.